Two of the most famous characters of the ancient Britons are not even mentioned in the legendary account of the period by Arviragus and Claudius. We have been proving that the literature is there, the information is there, to trace the kings of Britain from Brute right on up to Constantine. These two that are not mentioned are Caractacus and Boadicea. Now, Caradoc, whom the Roman historians call Caractacus, was the king of the Silures, or the Silurians. In his heart, in his mountain fastness, he was long able to defy the power of the Romans. He was the first guerrilla fighter. They never whipped him. As we've seen, the Emperor Claudius, returning to Rome, made the absurd claim to the honor of having crushed the Britons. All he did was dump a daughter on them. The work of conquest was by no means accomplished except on a daughter. Vespasian continued the war in the southwest, and the Roman general Ostorius Scapula advanced to the mountains of Cambria or Wales. And it's an amusing fact that a range of highlands in England is known today as the Oyster Hills, from a corruption of this officer's name, Ostorius Scapula. For upon these hills he pitched his camp. You cannot understand England without understanding history. Oyster Hills. Continuing on. Caractacus made the most desperate. It's this damn fertile imagination of mine to bog all this teaching down. Help me now. It's all around the water tanks. Caractacus made the most desperate resistance all around the water tanks to the advance of the Roman forces. He was animated. What it says right here, he was animated. Now, I'd hate to not be able to be animated. So don't laugh at the man, it's an accomplishment. He was animated by the purest patriotism, and his ability and bravery challenged the admiration of his foes. Got to be animated for this. The contest lasted 9 years. I ain't going to touch that or anything. Caractacus, Caradoc, my lord, all around the water tanks. It was a very unequal struggle. I bet it was. I guarantee you, it was. It was a very unequal struggle. Poor Caractacus. Now, if you just tuned in Georgia and Michigan, you wonder how anybody could get so worked up over such a short story. We've been at it 3.5 years. Hours. It was a very unequal struggle. Poor Caractacus had to get... Yeah, he did. That's what it says right here. Poor Caractacus. Poor Caractacus had to contend with the best equipped. Best trained soldiers of the world. Oh, Lord. And Rome was determined to complete the conquest at whatever cost. Phew. The story of this noble Briton. Saint he was. The story of this noble Briton is told in the elegant pages of Tacitus, the Roman historian. and also in the books of Suetonius, the Latin biographer of the 12 Caesars. I read that through yesterday. In fact, I was going to bring that tonight. There's an old English drama by William Mason. Just, I'm trying to make one point. As I stayed on one subject longer than I have ever. I'm trying to make one point that we get a gestalt, a feel for the fact the information's always been there. Why hasn't somebody brought it out before? There's an old English drama by William Mason, which has not been played for more than a century, which is interesting to read. It portrays the last desperate struggle of the Britons under Caractacus. In one of its scenes, remember way back there when that brother, the two sons, hid his sword in a tree? William Mason's drama picked up on that. In one of its scenes, a high priest of the Druids delivers to the king the sword of Belinus, said to have been hidden for ages in the hollow of one of the sacred oak trees. These are the words which the priest presents, or with which the priest presents the inspiring relic. Caractacus, behold this sword, the sword of old Belinus, stained with the blood of giants, and its name, Trophingus. Many an age its charmed blade has slept within yon consecrated trunk. Lo, I unsheath it, king. I wave it o'er thee. Mark what portentous streams of scarlet light flow from the brandished falchion. On thy knee receive the sacred pledge and mark our words. By the bright circle of the golden sun, by the brief course of the errant moon, by the dread potency of every star that studs the mystic zodiac's burning girth, by each and all of these supernal signs, we do adjure thee with this trusty blade to guard yon sacred oak whose holiest stem involves the spirit of high Tyrannis. This be thy charge, to which in aid we join ourselves and our sage brethren with our vassals, thy son, and the Brigantian prince shall make incursions on the foe. Caractacus responds on receiving the sword in the drama. Old as I am, I trust with half our powers I could drive back these Romans to our ships. Dastards that come as doth the cunning fowler, to tangle me with snares and take me tamely. Slaves, they shall find that ere they gain their prey, they'll have to hunt it boldly with barbed spears and meet such conflict as the chaffed boar gives to his stout assailants. O ye gods, that I might instant face them. But all was in vain. Despite their valor, the Silurians were overpowered. But the king, as I said, the earliest guerrilla fighter, fled to the Brigantes, another British tribe whose prince the high priest mentioned in his address. Here he might expect to find followers to renew the fight, but the Romans fought not only with swords, but with gold. And you know, the fruit doesn't fall very far from the tree. All through the history of these sons of Jacob, you got these kind of problems. Cartis Mandua, queen of the Brigantes, received him only to betray him to his foes, and Caractacus fell into the hands of Ostorius, who carried the fallen chief to Rome to grace his triumph. By the way, somebody from Kentucky said, when I come to Kentucky, leave this coat home because they've seen me wear it for 3 months. What about those priests? Wear the same collar and the same black shirt for 10 years. And that Pope's been wearing that fish head cap for 2,000 years. Not quite. About 1,500. That hurt me. In the magnificent triumphal procession which swept through the great city after Caradoc, called Caractacus by the Romans, had been betrayed through treachery, the British captive Caradoc was led in clinking chains. As he passed through the streets and saw the grand structures on either side, he exclaimed, "Is it possible that a people possessing such magnificence at home should envy me my humble dwelling in Britain?" Tacitus, in the 12th book of his Annals, says of this spectacle that the senators pronounced it no less glorious than when Scipio exhibited Syphax or when Paulus paraded the Macedonian Perseus in the streets of Rome. The bravery of this great Briton Caradoc and the dignity with which he bore his misfortunes touched the heart of the emperor who set him free. Tradition says he died at Rome some years later. Thus, British independence, which originated through Greek despotism, according to the story of Brute, was coming to its end through the Roman love of conquest, according to history. Maybe here I should stop and read Isaiah 53 and then follow with Isaiah 54. The lost tribes, their king went before them, one of the minor prophets said. We traced it through the Zara line to Dardanus and Troy, by the Aeneid to Carthage and to Rome, where marrying the daughter of the Latin king, Romulus is born, and they play their part in the Roman kingdom, as they have in the Grecian and the Trojan. Brutus goes on to Spain to find other descendants of Zara, the peninsula of the Iberus. He goes to Britain and founds New Troy. His lineage is now into the first century, when the Romans are going to conquer and we are past Isaiah 53. Sing, O barren, the wife of the youth that's been rejected will now bring forth more children than the wife that stayed. Not a part of this story, because this is just a history book. Is that other strand that God was weaving? He had hand-picked in time Joseph of Arimathea. He must have thought he was a smart businessman when he developed a fleet of ships plying the tin merchants' trade and was able to walk with ease in two power centers as a member of the Sanhedrin, powerful in the Jewish council, as the noblesse decorum, minister of mines under Pilate in the Roman government. Not consenting, the scripture says, to the death of Jesus, but with the power and influence to ask for his body, to lay it in that grave and fulfill prophecy. Too powerful as a Christian after the resurrection to be destroyed through the influence of the Sanhedrin, he with the household of Bethany and other famous associates of Jesus, within 3 to 5 years after the resurrection of Christ, are put in a ship without oars and sail. They drift to the African coast, get sails and oars, and make it to Marseille, where the family that's with him are left in the French coastal valleys. Well, he goes on the trip that he had made so many times as a power for Rome, on, no doubt, close association with the Silurian king. He brings the gospel and converts the daughter of Caradoc. Bran, the father of Caradoc, had already resigned his position as a Silurian king and has become a Druid priest. Caradoc has watched his sister and his daughter become Christian under the influence of Joseph of Arimathea. That's another story, not in this one. Caradoc arrives in Rome. William Cullen Bryant speaks of Greece and Rome in his poem, The Ages. Tacitus speaks of the scenario. And left out of this story is the speech that Tacitus records where Caradoc so moved the Roman Senate that instead of being slain as the king is normally done, Claudius is persuaded to grant him house arrest parole and allow him to live off of some of the revenue from his Silurian kingdom. And it is his household to which the Roman letter by Paul is deposited. His daughter Gladys is given in marriage, or rather in adoption, to Claudius, and her name changes to that of the Roman emperor, Claudia. She's given in marriage to Rufus Pudens, former praetor at Glastonbury in the Roman army, now a senator in Rome, that Paul will address as possible half or full brother when he speaks of the mother of Rufus and mine. And suddenly the personalities of Romans 16 and 2 Timothy 4 come alive when you have a historic backdrop. But I'm still heading for Constantine. That's another subject in the book about Paul. Where is that book? Craig Lamp was supposed to have it printed by now. Yeah. Did Paul visit Rome? I want that by Easter. Lord, help us get it by Easter. We're supposed to have it for Christmas. Sing that song about Craig Lamp again. After Ostorius, from whom Oyster Hills were named, retired from Britain as the soldier or the general of Rome, Didius Gallus represented the Roman authority in the island for a time. He was succeeded by Varanus, who died after a year. Then came Suetonius Paulinus, whose name is linked forever with the tragic death of Queen Boadicea. Suetonius resolved first to overthrow the power of the Druid priests, since he regarded them as a perpetual menace to the Romans. They studied 20 years. They brought the knowledge of Egypt. They have been misrepresented by the Romans, who called everybody barbarians who were different than them. Only in the last few decades has research started unfolding the knowledge of the Druids. In the year 61, he crossed the strait into the island of Anglesea, called by the Britons Mona. This was perhaps their most holy place. It required all the courage the Roman soldiers possessed to face the scene that confronted them. In the sacred groves were gathered the fierce British warriors in war paint, the priests and priestesses with frantic screams and imprecations. He incited them to the most desperate resistance. Even the sacred alders offered no security, however, to the Druids. The Romans prevailed. The priests and priestesses were ruthlessly slain, the groves cut down, the alders overthrown. While the Roman general was thus engaged, the Queen of Iceni seized the opportunity to organize a revolt. Her British name was Bunduka. She was the widow of Prasutagus, as determined as Caractacus. She was able to command and strong in resources. Had the Romans translated her name instead of distorting it in their absurd fashion, they would have called her Victoria. When she protested to the Roman general against the seizure of her wealth by his officials, she met with scorn and insult and was even whipped with switches. Unspeakable outrages were perpetrated upon her daughters, and the maddened queen went from tribe to tribe among the Britons, appealing to their chivalry and to their patriotism. In a rush like a whirlwind, she led her followers against the Roman camps and towns. And 70,000 men are said to have fallen before her arms. A bloodthirsty bunch of women. Don't ever sleep in their presence. Then Suetonius hastened from Mona. Telling you, I've seen a couple of you men go to sleep in here occasionally on the long hours on the phone. You ain't very smart. You ain't listening to your teacher. Then Suetonius hastened from Mona to retrieve the disaster. The revolt of the heroic queen was the destruction of her nation. The final battle occurred near London. 80,000 Britons, as history tells us, fell on that awful field. A climax of horror besides which the battles in our less destructive modern warfare seem almost trivial. A terrific picture was presented by this maddened queen as she rode about the field, her yellow hair screaming in the wind and her voice calling aloud for vengeance on her foes. Unable to survive the extinction of her people, Boadicea drank poison and joined the number of the great dead. Tennyson's unconventional poem, which bears her name, is so striking in its portraiture, it's inserted here entire. While about the shore of Mona, those Neronian legionaries burnt and broke the grove and altar of the Druid and Druidess. For in the east, Boadicea standing loftily charioted, mad and maddening all that heard her in her fierce volubility, girt by the half tribes of Britain near the colony, Camolodun, yelled and shrieked between her daughters for a wild confederacy, and on it goes for 2, 4, 6, 7 pages. I'm only wanting to make a point. You can read the poems. It's all been written down. Nobody connected it from Brut, which connects it to Dardanus, which connects it to Zara, Egypt, and Israel. William Cowper, who was the leading poet of Great Britain more than a century ago, wrote a stirring ode in which he gave the prophecy of a Druid bard directed against the cruel Romans. He assumed that the royal house of modern Britain is descended from the ancient British kings, and made the bard predict the rise of a far greater empire than the Roman with its seat in Britain, a prediction which has long been fully realized. That ode is likewise inserted here. When the British warrior queen, bleeding from the Roman rods, sought with an indignant mien counsel of her country's gods, sage beneath the spreading oak sat the Druid, the hoary chief. Every burning word he spoke, full of rage and full of grief. Princess, if our aged eyes weep upon thy matchless wrongs, 'tis because resentment ties all the terrors of our tongues. Rome shall perish. Write that word in the blood that she has spilt. Perish, hopeless and abhorred, deep in ruin as in guilt. Rome, for empire, for renown, tramples on 1,000 states. Soon her pride shall kiss the ground. Hark, the Gaul is at her gates. Other Romans shall arise, heedless of a soldier's name. Sounds, not arms, shall win the prize. Harmony, the path to fame. Then the progeny that springs from the forests of our land, armed with thunder, clad with wings, shall a wider world command. Region Caesar never knew, thy posterity shall sway. Where his eagles never flew, none invincible as they. Such the bard's prophetic words, pregnant with celestial fire, bending as he swept the chords of his sweet but awful lyre. She, with all a monarch's pride, felt them in her bosom glow, rushed to battle, fought and died. Dying, hurled them at the foe. Ruffians, pitiless is proud. Heaven awards the vengeance due. Empire is on us bestowed. Shame and ruin wait for you. He wrote it a century ago. And this was written in 1903. That means he wrote it about 1800. And Britain became that great kingdom. It's interesting to read this imaginary prophecy in the light of history today. Region Caesar never knew, in South Africa, in Asia, in America, in the Isles of the Ocean, are commanded by the progeny which sprang from the forests of Britain, the progeny armed with the thunder of cannon, clad with wings of steam and electricity. The Lady Claudia was the first British Christian. That's not... Well, let's go on. The Lady Claudia was the first British Christian, if we're to accept the story the Welsh tell of her. Claudia was a native of Britain, a famous beauty and social leader at the great world capital, Rome, and a personal friend of St. Paul. Then there was Pudens, high officer of the imperial household. Lady Claudia was the daughter of a British prince. Sure was. Caradoc. Again, writers have picked it up. I've told you that story, so I'm going to skip along. Pudens and Claudia were married at Rome, and we may judge that the wedding was a brilliant social event from the attention it received at the hands of the Latin poet Martial. This witty writer of epigrams was called upon to celebrate in elegant verse the doings of Roman notables. in book 11 of his epigrams, we find the 54th is in honor of the bride. It begins as follows: "Our Claudia, see, true Roman though she springs, from a long line of painted British kings. Italia's self might claim so fair a face, and Athens envy her matchless grace." Another epigram by the same author, the 13th, contained in book 4, relates to the wedding. It runs thus: "Claudia, late from abroad, old Rufus has wedded my Pudens. Let us cry, hail, all hail to thy nuptial torches, O Hymen. Happily are the nard and the delicate cinnamon mingled. Happily are the Thessian wares with the Massican honey." On. This Italian really gets carried away. You know, if I read another line, he'd start singing. And still another epigram. The same poet playfully refers to the heir of Encolpus, the son of Pudens, who is likely to have been the child of Claudia, and who may have inherited from her the famous tresses of British royalty. Friends of St. Paul, the traditional story of Claudia, she won her father to the new faith, and he wrote to St. Paul inviting him to visit Britain, and that the great apostle to the Gentiles wrote an answer to the invitation and later paid a visit to the British prince. And there's probably no fact of early Christian history as strongly supported by the early church as the fact that Paul visited Britain. But Joseph of Arimathea was there first, won the household of Caradoc, whose daughter won the king himself. Britain became Christianized very early. Later, when the country was overrun by Saxons, Christian Britons were driven into Wales, and it was necessary to convert the country anew. But even I'll lift, not from this book, Augustus when he comes. As St. Patrick has claimed to convert Ireland, and he didn't. Some claim Augustus converted England. He didn't. He himself testifies, "A house of the Lord was built already there by the Lord's own hands," which brings in the legends of where was Jesus between 12 and 30 as the ward of Joseph of Arimathea. But let's go on. Throughout the reign of Marius, the king and his court appreciated the benefit of the Roman influence in Britain. Marius sent his son Cole in infancy to be reared in Rome. Cole succeeded Marius. He left a son, Lucius, who is remembered in legend as the first Christian king of the Britons. Well, let's just move on. He's mentioned in Bede's Ecclesiastical History. Lucius passed away in the year 156. He left no son to succeed him. A period of confusion followed in which many local chieftains contended for power. Joseph of Arimathea enters the scene. His descendants come suddenly on the stage of British kings. In the years 83 and 84, the Roman general Agricola, father-in-law of Tacitus, subdued Caledonia. In the reign of the Emperor Hadrian, Britain became an imperial residence. Hadrian made a tour of his vast empire, spending many years in his large provincial cities. In 119, he went to York, and Britain had already been Christianized. Here as elsewhere, he effected many improvements. To protect his area and province from northern raids, he built a long wall of earth and wood from the Eden River to the Tyne. The vast structure erected by Hadrian to be his tomb and known as the Mole is now the famous castle of St. Angelo. Lord Byron, the English poet, speaks thus slightingly of this wonderful tomb in Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, and another writer moves on the scene. Again was Britain deemed worth the personal efforts of a Roman emperor. Septimius Severus, one of the ablest, came to the island in the year 208, bringing with him his two sons, Geta and Caracalla, leading an immense army. Pressing to the north, he lost 50,000 men. Nevertheless, he conquered the territory. One of the most marvelous of great public works was the famous wall which Severus built across the islands as a barrier. I'm racing now. While Severus was at York, his son Caracalla, who is known in British legend as Bassianus, made an attempt to murder him, but the attempt failed, and the kind-hearted father pardoned his son. The famous painting represents the base culprit face to face with the emperor, and I got the picture of it here. Face to face with the emperor, who lies weak from illness and who's reproaching the young man for his awful crime. There's your picture. Art galleries have got the history, if you know it. He passed away at York, and the army, dreading a civil war between the two brothers, proclaimed them joint emperors. The Roman historian Herodian has given an account of the splendid work of Severus in his long and arduous campaign. For about 2 years after the emperor's death, his two sons remained in Britain. On their return to Rome, I'm wanting you to get a picture here of the seat of the Roman Empire temporarily being translated to York. We get the picture. Everything's at Greece and Rome. It wasn't. The Christian church has been founded, and the first church above ground is built at Glastonbury. And the Roman Empire, its emperor is living in Rome. 2 years afterwards, the emperor's two sons remained in Britain. On their return, Geta, one of the brothers, was murdered by Caracalla, who now reigned as emperor without a rival. Carausius, a man of low birth, seized the government at London. He professed great friendship for the Roman Senate and people and was entrusted with the command of a large fleet. He's said to have sailed entirely around the island. He was, however, a traitor to the Roman cause. The legend charges him with Caracalla's death. So this is an error. Carausius threw off the Roman yoke, reigned for a time as an independent king. He was slain by Allectus, his chief officer, who succeeded to the throne but who failed to maintain himself in his ill-gotten power. The Britons rallied around, listen close, a Cornish chief. Now we're back to the brutish line, named Asclepiodotus, and marched upon the capital. Boy, there's a name for you. Asclepiodotus. 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 I've said this before, but this one's even worse. Try pillow talk with that. Asclepiodotus. Asclepiodotus, are you asleep? Marched upon the capital. Lectus fled but was pursued and killed. The siege of London followed and the walls were beaten down. When the city fell, the Roman allies of Lectus were beheaded by the conqueror, the Cornish chieftain Asclepiodotus. Asclepiodotus was triumphantly crowned king at London. He was recognized as a British officer under the Roman general Constantius Chlorus. When Asclepiodotus was king, a great persecution of Christians was ordered by the Emperor Diocletian. Really felt in France. It extended to all parts of the empire, and vast numbers of martyrs suffered cruel deaths. Many of the churches in Britain were destroyed, numerous Christians sealed with their blood their testimony for Christ. The first of these martyrs, or at least the most conspicuous, was Alban, who is remembered with affection and admiration, a native of the Roman town of Verulamium in Britain, when as a young man he went to Rome with a dear friend whose name was Amphibolus. For 7 years served in the Roman army. Legend tells us, here's a legend for you. As the Roman officers were leading Alban to execution, a multitude followed and a notable miracle was performed. When they came to the river Thames, a dry path was opened for them through the riverbed, and the water stood up like solid walls on either side. Why do they like to tell that story? Maybe it did. Through this, Alban and his captors passed, followed by 1,000 people. The executioner who was to kill Alban was so overcome by the sight he refused to perform the deed, choosing rather to be himself a martyr. He was at once slain by the other officers. This story is told in an ancient book by Gildas the Wise, of whom little or nothing is positively known. Nobody doubts that St. Alban died for his faith. Some doubt the full details of the story. The persecution of Diocletian continued with great fury. In St. Alban's Abbey, was built in memory of that martyr. All over England, every one of these stories is memorialized in drama, in verse, in literature, in art, in monuments, or in architecture. Hurry up, Peter. I'm going to drop this book. Can't you get in on that picture? There we go. The name of the king who followed Asclepiodotus. Remember, I went through a lot of boring stuff. You can get so confused you will lose the threads. But we picked the thread up with the Cornish king, one of the sons of Brute. Now his son is better known to the children of the English-speaking world today than almost any other ruler who ever lived. And yet, nobody knew it goes back through Cornwall to Brute, to Troy, to Dardanus, to Egypt, to Zara, to Jacob, to Judah, to Jacob. You tell me God can't weave the tapestry? This Cornish chieftain, his son, is old King Cole. Old King Cole was a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he. Called for his pipe, and he called for his bowl, and he called for his fiddler's tree. Old King Cole was a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he. He called for his pipe, and he called for his bowl, and he called for his fiddler's tree. How many sang that when they were a kid? He just sang it. Cole may have been a merry old soul in his hours of relaxation, but he was a stern warrior, an energetic organizer, a forceful man throughout all his career. He overthrew people in battle. And when the Roman Senate sent to Britain the victorious King Constantius, who had conquered Spain, Cole determined to arrange a satisfactory peace with him. He proposed to pay to the Roman state the usual tribute, on condition he should retain in his own hands the government of his kingdom. He was entirely successful. Constantius remained in Britain, again Rome moving its headquarters, retaining a general oversight of the Roman interests in that country. If Rome thought England was that important, why has history neglected it? Cole is best remembered as the builder of the city of Colchester, which in Roman days was a place of great importance. You'll find Chester on lots of names. Now, those cities were not named after the deputy who now rides a horse in New York and changed his name. I mean, I don't know why Chester, if he's going to ride the horse, he got delivered of his limp, got on a horse and changed his name. Night tries to tell me how to invest money walking around on a farm or a beach. No, these towns were not named after him. Chester is a corruption of the Latin word castra, meaning camp. So they had these camps, and Cole's camp would be Colchester. See how easy that is? Cole is best remembered as the builder of the city of Colchester, which in Roman days was a place of great importance. The city bears the name of its founder, to which is added the corruption of the Latin word castra, meaning camp. This termination, sometimes varied in form, has found the names of a number of cities in Great Britain. Winchester, Lancaster, Worcester, Gloucester, Gloucester. There can be no doubt of the magnificence of the old city of Colchester, the time of Roman supremacy. Cole had no son to succeed him. Oh, my Lord, we're going to lose this line of the kings. His only child was his daughter Helena, who is represented to have been as beautiful as the Helen of Trojan story. Interesting, she's named Helena. Helena is carefully educated. Nobody pays any attention that you read one of the recent children born to the kingly line in Britain was named Zara, another was named Pharaohs. Nobody pays any attention. Helena was carefully educated and said to have excelled in music. Probably the king himself was a lover of this art. The pipe for which he called in the nursery song was not a tobacco pipe, most likely, but a musical instrument. His bowl may have been a cup of wine, most likely. King Cole died very suddenly after an illness of only 8 days. Constantius was married almost immediately to the beautiful Helena. Isn't it interesting? The guy dies, mysterious illness of only 8 days, and the Roman emperor just happens to be spending his time in England again. The beautiful Helena, daughter of King Cole, is married. The marriage having been arranged before the death of her father to Constantius. Constantius continued to reside in Britain for 11 years. You know, that's longer than some emperors of Rome ruled. Administering the affairs of the realm, at the end of that time, Constantius died at York. How many of you knew that? Not very many. Constantius and Helena had a son who was destined to fill the world with his fame. This was Constantine, who later became Emperor of Rome. He built the proud city of Constantinople, united the kingdom, made it a great capital of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, and he it was who, of all the emperors, first became a convert to the Christian faith, made it the religion of the empire, called the council that produced the Nicene Creed, and has the famous conversion story in which he saw the cross, the flaming cross, with the words and living light, in hoc signo vinci, by this standard thou shalt conquer. Helena is famous in the history of the church, was declared to be a saint as well as an empress, and any study of the reopening of the Holy Land to Christians begins with Helena. In an excavation which she conducted at the traditional site of the crucifixion, she is said to have discovered the true cross upon which he had suffered death. Most likely not true, but she did dig there. She brought also with her, when she came back to Europe, she claimed to bring this cross back with her, and claimed to bring the skulls of three men, she said, were the wise men of the East. Archaeology got a little more scientific, but you got to give the old broad credit for starting the digs. These are the three men described at length in the opening chapter of Lew Wallace's famous novel, Ben-Hur. The skulls she brought back have been carefully preserved to this day, and now repose in the great cathedral of Cologne in Germany. By the way, I could take a side road here on the spear that pierced Jesus' side, the spear of destiny. We left that dangling, didn't we? You will read of Constantine and perhaps of Helena in the history of Rome. They won't say much about the Christian trail through Joseph of Arimathea that joined in the line, and the trail of Zara to Dardanus to Brute to the kings of England that produced the daughter that joins in the line of the emperor. Did the promise of God to Abraham and Sarah, out of thee will come many kings, be fulfilled? No one doubts that Constantius died in Britain or that Constantine lived there. Spenser, in Faery Queen, speaks of King Cole and Helena, which when the Romans heard, then gan this realm renew her passed prime, he of his name Colchester, built of stone and lime, which when the Romans heard, they hither sent Constantius, a man of mickle might, with whom King Cole made an agreement, and to him gave for wife his daughter bright, fair Helena, the fairest living wight, who in all goodly truths and goodly praise did for excel, but was most famous height, for skill in music of all in her days, on, of whom he did great Constantine beget, who afterward was emperor of Rome. It's always been there, the whole story. Now we're up to Constantine, and we have traced the lineage of Zara through Brute, through his son and the Cornish kings, to Constantine's father and mother Helena, to Constantine. We have the king ahead of him. in Britain. And we have the line of Judah sitting on the Roman emperor's throne, Christianizing the nation. You tell me God doesn't get his last laughs. I finished something. And your amount of praise overwhelms me. Do you realize I did it? I even waded through the boring part. But I left a few danglers en route. I did, I really did. I sort of hinted at the Joseph of Arimathea bit. Now, here's a little book. The Traditions of Glastonbury. One day a small boat from one of the large merchant ships anchored in the British Channel, tied up at the causeway of the lake village, a bearded man and a slim young boy in his early teens stepped ashore. And the object of this book is to answer the question, was that boy Jesus? A ward of Joseph of Arimathea, his uncle, after the death of his father Joseph, traveling with Joseph, the tin merchant, to visit England, the place of the Silurian kings. The miners at Cornwall still sing Joseph was a tin merchant. One day a small boat from one of the large merchant ships anchored in the Bristol Channel, tied up at the causeway of the lake village. A bearded man and a slim young boy in his early teens stepped ashore. There were no strangers to the villagers. They weren't strangers at all. The villagers crowded around to welcome them. You see, this merchant had been coming by their village for many years, on his way to the lead mines of the Mendip Hills. It was known that he held a very important position in the powerful Roman government and carried the title Nobilis Decurio. It was rumored, on good sources, that he owned many of the merchant ships that came to these isles from Rome and Phoenicia to barter for metal and other goods. The young lad was also known. He had accompanied his uncle on a prior visit, staying at the village, exploring the surrounding territory, while his uncle conducted his business at the nearby Mendip lead mine. But this time, a woman, perhaps in her early 30s, was with them. As the boy helped the woman ashore, the crew proceeded to unload various sized chests and sacks, obviously belonging to them. Accommodations were soon found. The baggage was carried to one of the tiny huts facing the estuary. In the weeks that followed, the merchant and the boy constructed a wattle hut similar to those of the village on a nearby island. The site they chose was at the base of a hill from which ran a spring of fresh water. Small game and fish were in abundance, and the marshy, fertile shores promised bountiful crops. When the hut was finished, the woman and the boy moved from the village to their new home. The merchant and his men sailed away. Jesus and his mother, Mary, were alone. Now, is that a story of fancy? Is that just fancy? Well, we'll see, won't we? The famous Glastonbury hymn, written by William Blake, 1757 to 1827, was his time span. They've sung it for years in Britain. Yet we grow up in the church here in the United States, never hear of these things. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? Was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills, and was Jerusalem builded here among those dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental flight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till I have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. I repeat, lost in that song. And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green? And was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? What happened to Jesus between 12 years of age and 30? Now, there are all kinds of legends. There are those that claim he visited Tibetan monasteries. But nowhere has the tradition lingered with solidarity and with substance of supporting facts and traditions like Glastonbury. Now, Joseph of Arimathea was the uncle . It would explain why that Jesus was left alone in Jerusalem and ends up talking to the Sanhedrin, the wise teachers in Jerusalem. It's not normal for parents in crowded times to leave their son, except Joseph of Arimathea, just a few miles out of Jerusalem, it would have been normal to leave him with his uncle. Joseph of Arimathea, remember, the Sanhedrin that the scripture says did not vote in the council session that condemned Jesus, called in Jerome's Vulgate, Nobilis Decurum, minister of mines under Pilate in the Roman Empire. Legend or tradition or fact has it, he had a vast fleet of ships. He plied the tin trade through the Mediterranean, landing at Marseille, up the valley, sometimes around the Straits of Gibraltar, around that peninsula named after the Abiru, the Hebrew, up to England. The tin miners still saying Joseph was a tin merchant. All tradition agrees Joseph died rather early. Jesus didn't work all of his life in his father's carpenter shop. Why do you think you see and hear nothing of him? He died while Jesus was young. Jesus became the ward of Joseph of Arimathea. Nothing makes more logical sense. Joseph of Arimathea wasn't taking camel trips to Tibet. Nothing makes more logical sense than that Jesus, as a teenager, would go on one of the trips with him. If a 12-year-old boy astounded the geniuses in theology, do you think he'd go back and drive nails in Nazareth? Nobody say a word for 18 years? Now, what if this British Isle had some vast, mysterious role in God's master plan for history? No. It's still a source of amazement that those marker stones at Stonehenge, 93 and 91, you draw a line through them and you just keep walking with a plumb line right, if you can swim good, through the Mediterranean, you would hit the pyramid in Egypt. Why that connection between the pyramid and Egypt? And you take what's called the Christ Triangle in the pyramid, and you sight it like a rum line off to the north and east, lay it on the north face of the pyramid, and put the Christ Triangle heading in a rum line right off to the north and east, it'll hit Johnny on the spot, Bethlehem. I mean, somebody a long time ago knew something we didn't know. And instead of man evolving from dumb savagery to its modern brilliance, we went downhill a long ways and are just getting it back. Where would you find that connection with Egypt? The Druidic priesthood. Those adepts that studied for 20 years that were misnamed by the Romans barbarians. They did no more sacrificing than anybody else in that day. They did it in Greece and they did it in Egypt, and we call them developed cultures. They sure did it in the Mesopotamian Valley. The Sumerians and the Akkadians were no slouch at sacrifice. And our word cannibal comes from Kanabal, priests of Baal. For centuries, we've had traditions and vested interest in history ignore the wealth of facts that have exploded since the turn of the 19th century. The digs of the Celtic tribes uncovering their culture at Hallstatt and Latin, all of it really bursting out of the 1800s. Cyrus Gordon's pioneer work that links the common heritage of the Jew and the Greek, the Hebrew and the Greek in Egypt. And this strange continued connection between the British Isles and some master attention to history. Why is it the most perfect measurement unit ever to be discovered by man, that so-called sacred inch or pyramid inch in the pyramid, only used in the Ark of the Covenant and in Solomon's temple, and is characterized and marked off as the long cubit? 25 of them, 25 of those inches is the long cubit in Ezekiel's projected temple, and most probably was used in the ark that Noah built, if you believe he built it. That inch, memorialized in stone in the pyramid, appears two other places, Britain and America. Now, since heat and temperature can affect measuring devices, they bury the metric or the measuring units, the standards of measurement in France. Down through 4,000 years, the British inch has deviated from the pyramid inch 1/2 of a hair's breadth. Now, it would make absolute ultimate sense as I leap around with those 70-league boots on some things we've been teaching on, that's old hat to you, that if Britain, those strange little islands with their circled stone monuments, with such an ancient history, if that little island was to play some important part, it would sure make sense that Jesus go there. He had 18 years, and he was already astounding the wisdom of Jerusalem when he was 12 years of age. Well, this book's about that. Now, the Bible's strangely silent concerning Jesus' movements between the ages of 12 and 30. The only incident of childhood recorded in the Gospels is his visit to the temple at about the age of 12. Now, this is old hat to you, so it's got to be boring you. Thanks for the encouragement. And I'm trying to get the food here for you. It's on the way, folks. The occasion was the Feast of the Passover, when lectures were given in the temple of Herod. There in the audience was the boy Jesus. Well, to skip along, he ended up answering the questions. The last New Testament account of the boy Jesus is found in Luke 2. Jesus increased in wisdom, stature, favor with God and man. 18 years pass. Silence. At age 30, he takes up his Galilean ministry. Consider the passage. He came to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up. And the eyes of all them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him, and they said, "Isn't this Joseph's son?" Do you know how little Nazareth was then? Do you really think he would have spent 18 years there and they'd ask that question? No way. "Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brethren James and Joseph and Simon and Judas and his sisters? Are they not all with us?" See, some are with, they're with us. His brothers and sisters. "Are they not all with us? Whence then hath this man all these things?" He was such a stranger. No way, unless he was gone. Now notice another one. when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, "Doth not your master pay tribute?" He said, "Yes." Now we know Jesus spent a lot of time ministering in Capernaum. That old town is really a derivation or a corruption of the Arabic word kafir for town. Capernaum. It was the town of Nahum. Seated on the shore, north shore of Galilee, they think they've discovered the house of Peter there in more recent archaeology, one of the finest digs of recent days. But Jesus ministered there as part of the Decapolis towns all the time. Comparing the account of the healing of the man sick with palsy, recorded in Matthew 9, with that of Mark 2, we find that Capernaum was described as his own city. Yet here was an inquiry being made about Jesus' liability, and you got to know the Greek here, to the stranger's tax, the Roman poll tax, leveled only on foreign visitors to Capernaum. He ministered so much it was called his own city, and yet he was asked, or his disciples were asked, if he paid the stranger's poll tax. He was considered a stranger to the customs officer in the city that should have known him all of his life. Consider when he appeared at the banks of the Jordan River. John was born 6 months before he was born. By the way, Jesus wasn't born December 25th. Glad you got that straight. He wasn't crucified on Friday either. And he didn't raise on Sunday morning. He rose from the dead Saturday night. And I will prove that to you. He was born not 4 B.C., which was an area, and he sure wasn't born 0 A.D., because there isn't any 0 A.D. You lose a whole year there. You go from 1 B.C. to 1 A.D. They thought in error he was born in 4 B.C., but he was born in 2 B.C. He went into ministry when he was 30. Now, my friend, when we come to Easter, I will prove those things, but that's another subject. Right now, he came to John the Baptist, and John was born 6 months before him, which is the way we'll be able to prove. You can prove from Scripture when John was born, and Jesus was born 6 months later. They're 6 months apart, they grow up, they're cousins. And John's preaching at Jordan, and he doesn't recognize Jesus when he comes. Now, where was Jesus during those times? Now, why the selection of Glastonbury? Well, we'll see.